Mike Honig on 90.1 KPFT-FM and FMHD 1 Houston, your community station. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hello.
This week we'll be discussing local, state, national, and international stories. In the first part of the show, we'll discuss hate crimes against Asian Americans. We'll also talk about tax season, disaster assistance, renter's aid, and the River Oaks Theater. Starting off, the next election, believe it or not, is May 1st, and the next early voting, believe it or not, starts April 19th. So we're now on 3/22, so that's what, 27 days. 27 days to early voting, and they don't even have the ballot finalized yet. Also, in case you haven't heard, tax day is changing. I don't want you to take my word for it. You can definitely check irs.gov. But the federal tax deadline has changed from April 15th to May 17th. As far as I know, for Texas and perhaps Oklahoma, Louisiana, it has changed to June 15th. But according to the IRS website, if you have state or local taxes you have to pay, those deadlines may not have changed. So consider this more of an alert.
Yeah.
Check.
Because this is all very confusing.
Yes. Basically, what is it? Trust but verify. Pretty much the only thing Ronald Reagan ever said that I quote. Also, you still have until through April 13th to get your car inspected and registered if you have not done so, if it's expired because of COVID, as mine has. You do have through April 13th. I checked last night, and that deadline still has not changed. So that's probably going to be a hard deadline. Okay, so one of the most important stories we've had this week is hate crimes. The specific story I've pulled is from APnews.com. Asian women say shootings point to relentless racist tropes, which is really just one aspect of the Asian hate crimes that we've been hearing about. I've taken some excerpts out of the story. For Christine Lewag Dixon and others, the bloodshed in Georgia was a new and horrible chapter in the shameful history of Asian women being reduced to sex objects. She says, I've had people either assume that I'm a sex worker or assume that as a Filipino woman, I will do anything for money because they assume that I'm poor, she said. She's a freelance writer and musician in New York City. She goes on, I had an old boss who offered me money for sex once. Tuesday's rampage at three Atlanta area massage businesses prompted Asian American women to share stories of being sexually harassed or demeaned. They say they've had to tolerate racist and misogynistic men who cling to a narrative that Asian women are exotic and submissive. The suspect in the shootings, a 21-year-old white man, considered the women inside the spas, quote, sources of temptation, police said. Grace Pai, a director of organizing at Chicago's Asian Americans Advancing Justice Branch, called that characterization of the attacks, quote, a real slap in the face to anyone who identifies as an Asian American woman. She goes on, we know exactly what this racialized misogyny looks like, and to think that someone targeted three Asian-owned businesses that were staffed by Asian American women and didn't have race or gender in mind is just absurd. Stereotypes of Asian women as dragon ladies or sexually available partners have been around for centuries. From the moment Asian women began to migrate to the U.S., they were the targets of hypersexualization, said Ellen Wu, a history professor at Indiana University. The Page Act of 1875 prohibited women coming to the U.S. from anywhere for, quote, immoral purposes, but the law was largely enforced against Chinese women. Wu goes on, as early as the 1870s, white Americans were already making this association, this assumption of Asian women being walking sex objects, Wu said. According to Catherine Siniza Choi at the University of California, Berkeley, a professor of ethnic studies and a Filipino-American woman, quote, in American society, Asian Americans are not seen and listened to. We are seen in specific ways, at specific times, as model minorities, as projections of white male fantasy, but we are not seen as full-fledged Americans. We are not seen as full human beings. She says it's a kind of erasure and dehumanization. Mm. My wife is Chinese, a naturalized Canadian-American citizen. My stepdaughter is ethnic Chinese, Canadian-American citizen, and they are concerned. My stepdaughter lives in Brooklyn in an apartment building on the west side of Brooklyn, and it's densely populated, and she has reservations that she's never thought about as ethnic Chinese. She's never particularly thought of herself as, I mean, she knows she's Chinese. She's proud of her heritage, but she's never thought of herself as looking different or that it matters. You know, it's like the difference between tall or short, fat or thin. And to her, white or Asian or black, I mean, she doesn't see the difference. And now she's become sort of hyper-conscious of it. It upsets me. It makes me sad. And of course, it's scary and despicable. Mm. Andrew?
Yeah. You know, especially with the threats that Asian American people were already facing, you know, being blamed for COVID-19 and all this, these sorts of racist rumors fueled by, you know, people who wanted to be xenophobic and wanted to have an excuse for it. And it's there's nothing to say other than it's abhorrent. That's just
It's hard to put into words. You know, you can have very intense feelings about it and still have trouble verbalizing it. Well, let's go on to the next story. We're going to come back in sort of a roundabout way to this topic later in the show. But in terms of going now to local news, so the River Oaks Theater, likely to close despite further negotiations. If you're familiar with the River Oaks Theater, and even though I don't go to theaters much, I do have sort of warm feelings. I used to go there from time to time when I was somewhat younger. And this has been sort of an ongoing story between the River Oaks Theater Company, Landmark Theaters, and Weingarten Realty. So this is how the story goes. After lengthy negotiations, Landmark Theater and Weingarten were not able to reach an agreement. Therefore, Landmark Theater has no choice but to close its doors effective next week, which is sometime the week of this show. No definitive date has been set. Landmark Theaters would like to thank the Houston community for their years of support. The March statement from Weingarten Realty reads, a day earlier, the Los Angeles-based theater firm said it had conceded some ground to Weingarten, which owns the property at 2009 West Gray. They said, Weingarten insists that during a substantial period of the extension term that Landmark pay the same rent prior to the pandemic. The pre-COVID rent reflects a different world that does not address the realities of today or the foreseeable future. Landmark has offered to pay an additional percentage rent to allow Weingarten to come close to the pre-COVID rent, it said. Weingarten has said the theater has missed rent payments for a year, but offered Landmark the option to pay back the balance over 2 years. A spokesperson for Landmark did not know whether the company sought payroll protection program loans amid the pandemic, including funds made available through the Save Our Stages Act that extended grants of up to $10 million to theaters starting in November. So from reading this story, and I mean, I've excerpted what I think are salient parts. We don't know whether Landmark applied for those funds. We really don't know the specifics of the negotiations. As someone who is a small-time landlord, I've certainly been trying to cut tenants slack. That is painful for me. I'm sure it's not fun for them. But, you know, the River Oaks Theater is a landmark on a couple of levels. It's a landmark in terms of its architecture, its interior decor, the big theater sign. It's a landmark as the River Oaks Theater, as the landmark theater, as a theater for small films and independent films and foreign films. It's you know, when I was single, I would go on dates there, and I'm sure there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people in Houston who would say the same. So, you know, whether you still go there or not, or you're a new generation of people going there until COVID, it's a sad thing to see a landmark possibly go away.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually never been there. There's quite a lot of Houston that I've never seen, because, you know, who?
Well, you're far away. Where are you, Pearland?
Yeah, Pearland, and also, you know, who has time to go outside anymore?
Well, that's a year of your life gone.
Yeah, who had time to go outside before all this is what I should be saying. But yeah, it is. You know, it's more of an abstract for me, but it's still sad to hear that a landmark, we're saying that word a lot today, of the community and of the, you know, community gathering spirit, you know, is going away. It's maybe a little, well, probably a lot improbable, but, you know, part of me hopes for a sort of Hollywood-esque, you know, a bunch of, you know, community members rally together to raise enough money to pay the rent, or, you know.
Kind of like an old Mickey Rooney movie with Judy Garland. Hey, gang, let's put on a show!
Yeah, exactly.
Except that's what the River Oaks Theater has been trying to do, apparently, with very limited success lately.
Yeah, to save the theater at the last minute, yeah, but... we saw this with, like, you know, AMC stock taking a dive and everything. Just, you know, places where people gather to do things are not doing well because the advice is not to gather. So
this is a change of eras.
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking about this now for a full year, and the world will resume, but it will not be the same. There will be changes, and the changes are not entirely readily apparent. It'll take time before we see how things settle, which is what happens when you have radical change in the world. You just don't know how things are going to sort out.
Yeah.
The next story we're going to cover is the Texas Rent Relief Program, which has been open for a month but has made only 3 payments. I got this article from thehoustonchronicle.com. The Texas Rent Relief Program has only made 3 payments despite being online for a month, according to a video shared with the Houston Chronicle. Brooke Boston, who is the Texas Department of Housing Community Affairs Director, we've paid 3 payments, which is better than none, but is way too few. He says, we had some major system issues happen, and so it's really only been maybe like 14 days that we've been fully in our new system. He goes on, this is a $1 billion rental assistance program that the state of Texas is standing up completely from scratch. While the funding will be extremely helpful to many thousands of Texans, it did not come with program guidelines or mechanisms for delivery, said the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs spokesperson Christina Terloni in an email. What was kind of ironic about this article is with this whole article about, you know, it's been up for a month and we've only made 3 payments, they did not provide a link in the story. Now, this is online. They did not provide a link in the story to tell you how to get this resource. Now, even if it wasn't an online story, they should have had a link in the newspaper. And I emailed the story's writer, never got a response, checked the program before doing the show, and they still hadn't added a link. So I will tell you, you can go to thinkwingradio.com and go to this story's blog post, and there is a link for the story, and I have added the link to the Texas Rent Relief Program, which, oddly enough, is texasrentrelief, one word, .com. And then there is a /#, apply-now. But I think if you get as far as texasrentrelief.com, you'll probably do fine. A well-kept secret, apparently. Even after it's been reported on, and even after they did their PR story.
Yeah. You know, they it mentions on the article, you know, that they had accessibility issues. And, of course, that's to be expected with any kind of new system that's being launched.
Like Obamacare, which the Republicans ripped mercilessly.
Exactly. That's exactly where I was going. We remember, well, anybody who accessed the site, because I was not old enough to need to find my own insurance at the time. I guess I'm old enough, but anyway. The system...
Well, the site does appear to be working better now because I did visit it, so...
Right, and yeah, and so you can, if you need this rent relief, go to the site, try to apply, because...
Your landlord also needs to apply, so you both need to be applicants.
Yes, so contact your landlord. If you have a tenants union, you know, they can probably help you, like, get your landlord's attention if necessary. So yeah, you know, make sure that you get this relief if you need it.
Okay. All right. After the break, we'll be talking about cheap retail space thanks to COVID, what it means to tinker with history curricula, capital sedition, and attempted voter suppression. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 in Houston. You can follow this show. Go to thinkwingradio.com. You'll see all the links and actually, even more detailed than we normally discuss on the air. You can go to all the stories that we cite on the air. Often I have cross-referencing for additional detail. And, of course, you can go to kpft.org and see what the station is doing, which I certainly advocate. kpft.org, you can see what show schedules are. You can go to the archive, which is archive.kpft.org, where you can listen to shows that are saved for anywhere from 2 to 8 weeks, depending on the show. You can also click on links that will allow you to podcast favorite shows. And what's also nice about it is if you don't happen to like the show that's on the air, you can always listen to a show in the archive. So anywhere in the world, any time of the day or night, you can listen to the show you like.
So don't complain to us.
If it's plural. So don't complain to us.
Don't complain to us. Just go on the archive and listen to a different show. no, don't do that.
Kind of. Maybe. Okay. So, next story. From CNBC.com, rent is cheap, vacant space is everywhere. Retailers seize the moment to open stores. And here's the story. For the first time in years, retailers plan to open more stores than they close. From Ulta Beauty and Sephora to Dick's Sporting Goods, Five Below, and TJ Maxx, businesses are rebounding from the COVID pandemic and looking to expand. Many businesses see an opportunity to sign shorter leases, which can allow them to experiment with different formats. Year to date, retailers in the U.S. have announced 3,199 store openings and 2,548 closures, according to a tracking by CoreSite Research. Following a tsunami of store closures in 2020, the retail real estate landscape is fraught with vacancies. Mall and shopping center owners across the country are looking for tenants to fill that space quickly. Meanwhile, some retailers are more optimistic, having made it through the dark days of the pandemic. They're looking to take advantage of a market where they largely hold more power over their landlords when they sign new deals or bring negotiations to the table. I mean, in a way, I'm kind of like a perfect example of this situation. I've basically been in home confinement for the better part of a year. Go out very infrequently, step outside my door, but, you know, go outside my little subdivision almost never. I've now had my first vaccine shot, Moderna. I'll be getting my next shot in about a week and a half. And about 2 to 3 weeks after that, I intend to be going out more. I intend to be doing more physical shopping, driving, picking things up, dropping things off, buying gasoline for the car for the extra mileage that I'll be doing. So, I mean, I'm going to be generating my small 70-year-old man amount of commerce for the economy, which should be less than your 22-year-old level of commerce for the economy.
I don't know, to be honest.
In theory.
I do most of my shopping online already, to be honest. But, you know, there's probably some things that I could do outside of the home that I haven't been doing recently. Can't necessarily think of them off the top of my head, but...
One of the first things I intend to do is get a haircut, hoping that the barbershop I found is still in business.
Yes.
Because I've been using a beard trimmer.
I also need a haircut. I've just been letting it grow out, and while I don't hate how I look with long hair, I think I do prefer how I look with short hair, so, you know.
Well, there's also things like clothing. You know, I've done basically all my shopping online, and there are certain things for which shopping online is ideal. I can read comments, I can see stars, I can get features that most salespeople on a retail floor don't know. So, for hard goods, essentially, online shopping has enormous advantages. But when it comes, like, I don't buy dress clothes, but, for example, t-shirts. Not undershirts, but t-shirts.
Right.
Or sweatpants, or sleep shorts, or socks. Unless you can feel them, look at them, see them, feel the weight of the fabric, look at the quality of the sewing. And, of course, colors are never right on a computer screen. It's just almost impossible unless you really, really work at it with a test card and stuff. So those are the kinds of things I'll probably be doing. I need house clothes. You know, my house clothes are wearing out, and I have not been able to find anything satisfactory shopping online. Either I keep it and decide I don't like it, but it's too much of a hassle to send back, or I send it back.
Yeah. Fair enough.
These are the kinds of things that, as one person, not a young person who spends a lot of money on entertainment and going out and dating and things of that nature, but I do go out and spend money.
Sure.
And now I can do sort of some of my pent-up needs that I can go out and spend money on. So, you know, you multiply that by 350 million people. As Everett Dirksen once said, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you're talking real money.
And, you know, we're talking about commercial properties being rented here. But I wonder if there's going to be a similar thing in the residential market.
Well, the residential market is tight because people haven't been building houses. You've got people shopping for houses, but the workers to build them haven't been going out to build them.
Right.
Plus, we've had some situations where material costs are very high, and that has also been a deterrent for builders. I think there will come a point, probably within the next 6 months, more or less. You have to pull permits and things of that nature, but I think probably by the end of the year, I think you'll see a significant increase in housing starts, again, trying to meet pent-up demand. So housing prices that have been climbing at an unusually fast rate, I think you'll see some of those recede as new housing comes onto the market. But, you know, retail space, commercial space, tends to be standing space. It's not space that people typically wait in line for unless it's ultra desirable. So I think that the situations are exactly opposite between commercial and residential, but that's just my opinion.
Interesting.
So this is a bit of a more serious story. Big implications, rather. What happens when a slogan becomes the curriculum? A curriculum inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement is spreading, raising questions about the line between education and indoctrination. This is from theatlantic.com. Last month, a public school district that serves mostly elementary and middle school students in Evanston, Illinois, held its third annual Black Lives Matter at School Week of Action. Using a curriculum created in collaboration with Black Lives Matter activists and the local teachers union that introduces children as young as 4 and 5 to some of America's most complex and controversial subjects. For example, parents of kindergartners in District 65 in Illinois were asked to spend time at home discussing a book on race that teachers had read aloud to their children. In Evanston, parents are asked to quiz their kids on whiteness and give them approachable examples of how whiteness shows up in school or in the community. In its focus on whiteness and its invitation to readers to challenge racism by interrogating and rejecting it, the worldview of the book Not My Idea is similar to that of Robin DiAngelo's book White Fragility, now a staple of diversity and inclusion programs and anti-racism training. Not My Idea is also a jarringly didactic assignment for kindergartners. The BLM at school movement is gaining momentum in Democratic strongholds around the country, where millions have felt impelled to respond to the high-profile police killings of Black Americans and the inequities that such incidents expose. Parents and educators in these enclaves are largely united in believing that Black lives matter and that schools should encourage students of all ages to reject racism and remedy its injustices, much as previous generations of school children were taught to just say no to drugs and reduce, reuse, recycle. Indeed, with the educational resources it creates and curates, the National BLM at School Coalition unapologetically aims to create a new generation of allied activists, and that influence shows in Evanston, where, starting in the spring of 2019, the District 65 Educators Council, the local teachers' union, proposed to work with administrators to develop a local BLM at school curriculum. By autumn, the school board had approved a week of lessons. The curriculum, which district leaders say aligns with Illinois social studies standards and guidelines, draws on the materials and guiding principles of the national initiative, while also adding texts such as Not My Idea, which doesn't appear on the National BLM at School's current list of recommended books. The committee that formulated the current National BLM at School classroom resources is chaired by Christopher Rogers, a veteran of organizing in Philadelphia. The Black Lives Matter movement is within its rights to focus exclusively on Black people killed by police. Speeches, and the reason I'm hesitating here is because this was written in a first-person account, and I'm trying not to do it as the first-person writer did it. Americans should also know the names such as Daniel Shaver, a white man killed by police in 2016. Speeches by Black Lives Matter activists need not include the disclaimer that white men are far more likely to be killed by police than Black women. But the public school system should tell the whole truth to those in its care, even if it undermines a narrative that activists champion. Basically, I think that the crux of this story is the line between education and indoctrination. I think it's fair to say that when we send young children to school, certainly through the elementary grades, it's as much indoctrination as education. We're not teaching them that the United States is just another country out of 100 or some in the world. We're teaching them that basically the United States is a country to be proud of, that it's a country that has done good things, that our revolution was the right thing to do. The British may have a different opinion. So, I mean, countries, and this is routine. The same thing is done with religion. You teach your children young that there is a God and that it's a Christian God or a Jewish God or a Muslim God or a Hindu God or whatever. And it's indoctrination. It's what they carry with them for the rest of their lives. But I've said many times in the show that there are three versions of history: the winner's version, the loser's version, and the truth. I believe in, as much as possible, given the span of history, I believe in teaching the truth of history. You can teach positive things about your country, in our case, the United States, while also saying the United States hasn't always done good things. Sometimes our federal government has done bad things. Sometimes American individuals or groups have done bad things, or states have done bad things. And sometimes those bad things ended up in a civil war. But, you know, the country does good things as well. We have established a rules order in the world. As imperial powers go, we've been relatively unoppressive. We've done bad things. We've occasionally overthrown governments. Governments have tried to overthrow our government. It's complicated. History is complicated. The world is complicated. And I think that it's certainly no better to teach the conservative view of history than it is to teach the liberal view of history. Conservatives, stereotypically, the United States has only done good in the world. Liberals, stereotypically, we have so much to be guilty for. The truth is somewhere in the middle, as truth usually is. So, and plus, when you talk about Black Lives Matter instruction, getting back to the Asian story, do they refer at all to hate crimes against Asians, legal discrimination against Asians, the fact that Asians are either looked down on or stereotyped. I mean, there's a lot to unpack here, and there's a lot to think about. It isn't just about Black Lives Matter. Andrew?
Well, I don't know if I'm going to be able to respond to everything you said, because I don't know if I'll be able to remember all of it. Damn, my short
attention. I got carried away.
Yeah. I think that I don't have a problem with the BLM at school curriculum. I think that, you know, I think that first off, one, and this is something that has been dealt with since BLM started, Black Lives Matter as a movement started. There are a lot of people who are under the impression that one movement takes away from another. So, you know, if one movement gains too much popularity, it pushes others into, you know, into the wings.
And, well, I mean, if I may interrupt just for one second, there is the headspace question.
Yes, but the thing is that, you know, to assert that one movement cannot be too popular without harming other movements is to ignore the fact that people can focus on different things at different times. It's to, you know, it's to try and police the you know, fervor that people have for, you know, justice in different movements. And, you know, it's to sort of not trust other movements to be able to, you know, manage their own time and to be able to be a significant force on their own. And so, you know, BLM at school doesn't take away from, you know, the movements of Asian Americans. It doesn't take away from the movements of Native Americans. It doesn't take away from, you know, any other movement for racial justice. And, you know, I would be perfectly willing to welcome, you know, an Asian rights or a land back curriculum at school as well, just, you know, to go on with the other examples I cited. But I think that's the important thing, is that, you know, racial justice movements do not compete. There is no real competition between them. There are going to be people who are more concerned with some movements than others, and, you know, that's probably because they have more of a personal significance to them. But that doesn't mean they don't care about the other movements. It doesn't mean they're not paying attention to them.
And we need to move on, but I mean, I don't want to imply that I think this is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that it's a thing that also needs to be considered in the context of, we have a lot of racism in the country. You, as they say in the musical South Pacific, you have to be carefully taught. And essentially, this kind of instruction is competing with whatever they learn at home, perhaps.
True.
And you have to start early. But
true.
I think, you know, racial sensitivity, ethnic sensitivity, acceptance, which I think is a key reason to have integration in schools and public places at a very young age. I think that some of that burden can be carried by simply teaching history in technicolor, if you will. Acknowledging, mentioning the contributions of various people from various countries, from various ethnic groups, from various religious groups. I mean, there were Jews who fought in the American Revolution. There were blacks who fought in the American Revolution. I don't know, but there may well have been Asians that fought in the American Revolution. There are important inventors that aren't mentioned by name, that invented things that mattered a lot. The expression, the real McCoy, actually refers to a black inventor who invented something that became sort of the classic piece of hardware. I think it was a railroad piece of hardware. I don't remember if it was brakes or latches or something, but it, you know, the real McCoy was, yeah, this is his mechanism. We can trust it. That's what that meant. That was a black inventor. Those kinds of things should be mentioned. It shouldn't just be the guy who invented 100 uses for peanuts.
Agreed.
They're, not that that's an inconsequential right. invention, by the way, but there's so much more.
Agreed. And I think there are educators who are trying to do that. And the education in most states in the U.S., I think, is moving that way anyway, and that's great.
It's a generational change.
It is a generational change.
And unfortunately, that means that a generation might not benefit from that. It might take one or two generations. And that's annoying because this is your life and your time.
Right.
It's a deep philosophical question as well as an educational and human rights question.
I would also say, just to, you know, quickly, that I think that there were some parts of this article that were sort of, you know, some people view it as something that shouldn't be taught at this level of education.
And it was a very long piece.
It was a very long piece.
Heavily excerpt.
I want to sort of counter that idea that, you know, Black Lives Matter and racial justice shouldn't be taught at the kindergarten level with the fact that I remember when I was in like the third grade, I got a worksheet on 9/11, and it, you know, it told the story, and it, you know, it didn't go into graphic detail, but this was, you know, a sort of mature thing. And, you know, this is maybe part of my reflecting my broader views, but I think that, you know, kids are ready for a lot more than they're generally given credit for. They're able to handle a lot more than they're generally given credit for. That's going to vary from, you know, each person. But, you know, if you go into something, if you have to communicate a complex or difficult subject to a child, if you go in with, you know, the honest truth as you know it, and you go in with the intention of helping them understand things that they don't understand, being open to their questions, you can communicate it quite effectively, I think. I'm no expert, well, but that's the impression I get.
Interestingly, you talk about getting worksheets on 9/11 in the third grade. In the fourth grade, when I was in the fourth grade, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
And I remember we going in the hallways and we would joke about when the bombs would start falling. I mean, they didn't cover the missile crisis, as I recall, in school. I don't remember it being talked about. So it was whatever I heard at home and whatever I might overhear on the news, because I wasn't, like, watching the news. But, you know, we were required to subscribe to either the Tribune or the New York Times. And, I mean, I don't disagree with what you've said. I think that starting early, starting young, teaching awareness, teaching, I know it can be a dirty word for some people, teaching sensitivity, empathy, if you will. I don't think those are bad things to start young. But in any case, we're now a few minutes past our break. We are hoping to cover a little bit on the Capitol attack, something about GOP voter suppression, which seems to be what they do, and IRS not auditing the rich the way they ought to. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD 1. Story links, extensive excerpts, more usually than I read, and even more if you go to the actual article, can be found at thinkwingradio.com. And what is the tab? You know this, actually, and I don't.
Yes, it's... Now you put me on the spot. It's Show Posts and More when you click on it, and I think it's... thinkwingradio.com/posts-page. That's what it is.
You see, you know it better than I do. Andrew does have some social media. Andrew, what is yours?
You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE and spelled the same on Tumblr at dominatei.tumblr.com.
And you can follow me on Twitter at ThinkWingRadio. You can also follow me on Facebook, ThinkWingRadio with Mike Honig. Terribly unoriginal. You can communicate with us. We would love to hear from you, your comments, your questions, even your suggestions of things you would like to hear us discuss. You can either go on Twitter and message me, not direct message, but you can, as long as, you know, it's nice. But you can follow me on Twitter. You can leave posts for specific shows at that show's post on the blog. You can also go to Facebook and just leave comments on Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Facebook.
And
because I'm on I'm an all the old man social media.
And I don't know whether I have my DMs open on Twitter or not, but I definitely have my Ask box open on Tumblr. So if you want to ask me questions about the show, or if you have something that you might want to talk about, I mean, you know, hey, we could use some interesting guests, I think.
And, of course, we're always talking about go to kpft.org, yes, learn about the station, learn about the shows, visit the archive, and consider clicking on the donate link.
Yes.
In case you can spare some bucks, a couple of bucks, a bunch of bucks. We're not picky. We're not proud. Another way you can support the station is to tell friends, tell acquaintances, tell people standing in line at the store, if you happen to be in a store, and if you happen to be in a line, if you happen to be within talking distance of someone while you're in line. All those things have changed now, so I don't even know how to describe what to do anymore. But do share your thoughts of the station or particular shows you like with others. That's another way of supporting us. It doesn't just have to be about money. Okay, quick story from the Washington Post. Evidence in the Capitol attack investigation is trending towards sedition charges, says the departing chief. Former interim U.S. Attorney Michael R. Sherwin reiterated Sunday that he thinks charges of seditious conspiracy could be brought against certain defendants in the Capitol breach, a rarely invoked charge for those who use violence to hinder the execution of federal law. Federal law makes conspiring to overthrow or oppose by force federal authority, including the use of violence to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of law, punishable by up to 20 years in prison. Sounds to me like pretty much the letter of what happened. Going on to the next story. This is actually kind of interesting, and I'm not going to go into as much detail as I accepted
here. And it's kind of related.
It is very related. And there are two stories here that are related. The first one, this is from news.yahoo.com. It's probably originally an AP story that's been reworked. An all-hands moment. GOP rallies behind voting limits. Democrats are trying to expand voting rights, according to Ted Cruz, to illegal aliens and, according to Ted Cruz, to child molesters. And Republicans, according to Ted Cruz, must do all they can to stop them. If they push through far-reaching election legislation now before the Senate, the GOP won't win elections again. In other words, if SR1 and HR1 are passed into law, basically what the story says is they'll never win another election. Essentially, to sum up this story, it all boils down to, if we can't suppress the vote and be picky about who is able to vote and where they can vote and how easy or hard it is to vote, Republicans feel like they'll never win an election. There is one point in the story, actually from a different story, but I have it included here, that points out that 7 of the last 8 presidential elections, let's see if I can find the exact wording, Republicans have lost the popular vote in 7 of the last 8 presidential elections, although the Electoral College system has placed their man in the White House. And it goes on to mention the fact that Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton despite losing the popular vote by almost 3 million votes. I think it was about 2.8 million. So essentially, this is a minority rule party.
Yep. And I want to say quickly, I understand some of the opposition to HR1, which passed, and now SR1, the For the People Act, especially from the third party and independent side, because there are a lot of, you know, the voting rights stuff is very good and is very important, but a lot of the campaign finance stuff is objected to. A particular third-party commentator analyzed that various thresholds for federal matching funds for presidential campaigns would be increased by, like, from 5,000 in 20 states total funds raised to, like, 25,000 in 20 states, which is an extreme increase. And, you know, that's just one example. There are a lot of more details about this you can find.
I mean, I haven't been able to read the article in detail,
right.
I apologize.
But, you know,
and Andrew has analyzed it. But I think, not necessarily saying that anything in the article is incorrect.
Right.
I think the devil is in the details. There may be some matters of interpretation to be had there, but I think the jury is still out.
Read the bill if you can understand it. You know, read some analysis from, you know, commentators who are concerned about this. Read some analysis from people who are in favor of the bill. Come to your own conclusions. But, you know, it's my personal belief, I want the campaign finance provisions thrown out. I want the rest passed. That's what I want.
Okay, then let me ask you this question. If you had a choice between passing it as is or tinkering with it to the point where you can't get enough votes to pass it, which would you choose?
I would choose tinkering with it.
But if you tinkered with it to a point that you couldn't pass it, which would you choose? Because that's what you're talking about.
Yes.
Obviously, this is a compromise.
Yes, I would tinker with it.
But it's a compromise that really enhances voter rights in addition to whatever else you may
agree
correct about financing.
And it's all well and good to have, you know, more voter rights, but if the election is down between, you know, basically two candidates who believe the same thing, it's not much of an election. So I would rather
that isn't the question. The question is, would you rather pass this bill as it is or tinker with it and then find it can't pass at all? Those are the two choices. Which would you choose?
For the third attempt at answering that exact question, I would tinker with it until it can't pass. That's what I would choose among those two options.
So you would prefer that it not pass than pass in its current form?
I do, because I believe that these voting rights provisions would pass on their own. They might need to be watered down a little bit or, you know, you could get rid of the filibuster maybe, because that's the big obstacle to HR1 or SR1. But I think that the campaign finance provisions alone, like, or taking the voting rights provisions alone would pass. Might need to be watered down, but they would pass.
I don't think we expected to spend this much time discussing this, but
sorry,
valid discussion. Nancy Pelosi is a very shrewd politician.
Mm.
The bill that will come out of the Senate will probably be very close to what passed out of the House. There will have to be a reconciliation because it'll never be identical. So the House sends it to the Senate. The Senate will discuss it. There'll probably be some changes at the edges. Maybe there'll be some changes in the finance provisions. Maybe they'll be better. Maybe they won't be. And then it'll go back to the House where they will pass it as the Senate sends it back to them, unless there's something reprehensible in it, which is unlikely because, you know, slight Democratic majority.
Again, assuming the filibuster doesn't stop it.
Assuming that for the moment. And I think the Democrats are really, really determined about this. And I think even Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema at some point will be brought around by pressure and negotiation from the Democratic caucus.
Entirely possible.
Something is going to happen, in my opinion.
Entirely possible.
I think that for Nancy Pelosi to send this to the Senate in the form that it's in, there was probably a great deal of horse trading within the Democratic caucus.
Mm.
So I suspect that it went to the Senate in the form it's in because that was the form she could pass. She doesn't bring something to the floor if she can't pass it. She's never brought something to the floor that she couldn't pass, ever. So, I mean, there's a lot to weigh here. To some extent, you're kind of reduced to, well, either I trust this politician to do what's possible or not. Just like I kind of trust Republicans to try to suppress the vote.
Mm-hmm.
There's never a pure solution to a problem. It's always complicated. I tend to value putting a floor under voting rights that states cannot go below because they have taught us that they will.
Sure.
So I think the campaign finance part can still be worked on in the future, but I think that the voting rights part is something that's historic and unprecedented for over half a century.
So
I think that's the key.
What really concerns me, though, is the campaign finance part. If it does pass, I think that because it gives so much advantage to the existing two parties, they will have very little, if any, reason to go back and change it. And so it'll be entrenched and it'll be very difficult to change. That's what concerns me. But I do want those expansion of voting rights and voting access to be passed. I think, you know, I really genuinely do think that the Republicans have a significant chance of just, you know, filibustering it and stopping it from passing. I wouldn't put it past them. I think underestimating them is not a good idea.
Let me quote Mary Poppins here for a moment.
Sure.
A spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down.
Yes.
So. And possibly And I don't know enough about it to say with any kind of dedication or any kind of passion, but it's possible that, assuming that the finance provisions in the bill are not ideal, maybe not for you, maybe not even for me, but maybe it's the spoonful of sugar that makes the voting rights medicine go down.
That's possible. It could be there to appease the Republicans. I didn't think about that.
Well, of course, Republicans are not going to vote for it, but there are moderate to conservative Democrats that may have needed it.
True.
So, you know, we talked a little while back in January about, well, you might not have to bring Republicans on board, but there may be some horse trading within the Democratic caucus, and this may have been some of that.
Mm.
Okay, let's see what else we can talk about here. Oh, yeah, we've got the government just admitted it doesn't really try to collect rich people's taxes.
Oh.
This is from Newsweek. By some estimates, the wealthiest 1% of Americans manage to avoid paying about $250 billion of owed taxes every single year. $250 billion. So basically $2.5 trillion in tax avoidance over 10 years, which is more than the tax cut that the Republicans gave those same people and companies. New government data shows that audits of the super rich and large corporations have hit a new low, leaving billions of dollars of uncollected taxes at precisely a moment when lawmakers say new revenue is needed. Now, the implication of this, of course, is for every dollar that you increase the budget at the IRS for auditing, they bring in somewhere between $1.50 and $6 in additional revenue. That means that you could spend a little bit more money at the IRS, bring in an extra $250 billion a year without raising taxes. You would be raising money, but doing it without statutorily raising taxes. Hmm. So it's kind of the old rule of, hey, we just have to enforce the laws that are on the books. Republicans say that all the time. Just enforce what's on the books. Great. Let's go ahead and enforce the tax laws.
Yeah.
The new Internal Revenue Service figures compiled by Syracuse University show that in the last 8 years, there's been a 72% drop in the number of audits of those making more than $1 million. 98% of those making more than $1 million did not face an audit last year. There's been a 55% drop in the number of audits of America's largest corporations. The situation is the result of both agency priorities and funding cuts. And, of course, Grover Norquist has been a vocal advocate of shrinking the federal government to the point where you can drown it in the bathtub, and destroying the IRS has been one of his prime goals and therefore one of the Republican Party's prime goals. Between 2010 and 2018, the IRS's budget has been slashed more than 20%, its enforcement budget cut by 24%. A July 2020 report from the Nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, found that increasing funding for the IRS by $40 billion would boost revenues by more than $100 billion over the next decade. To that end, Representative Ro Khanna and Representative Peter DeFazio, both Democrats, both in the Congressional Progressive Caucus, have recently introduced separate bills that would boost the IRS's enforcement budget and audit rates. Andrew?
I find it interesting that they've introduced separate bills.
As opposed to co-sponsoring something. That is interesting.
Right. The story also mentions that Khanna's legislation is more aggressive and would increase funding and require agency to audit certain sections, you know, majorities of certain, I guess, sectors of the business world based on size, which is interesting.
What's kind of interesting is the Congressional Progressive Caucus recently has been showing some serious muscle and influence.
Yeah.
And it surprises me, not that these two guys are coming up with different bills, but that within the caucus they couldn't reconcile to introduce one bill, which would have then had much more influence behind it.
Hmm.
So it's curious, just politically, as well as whatever the technicals are in the bills themselves.
It is, but, you know, you get a group of people together, they'll find something to argue about, so.
Yeah, that's true. Especially among Democrats. Lefties, they're all the same, no matter how far left they are. They debate who's leftier, or who's, well, anyway. It just is. It's politics, man. It's just politics. And in an indirectly related story having to do with rich people and rich companies not paying their fair share of taxes. The U.S. also ranks last in worker benefits among developed countries, so they've got it at both ends of the stick. In comparisons to other developed nations, the U.S. lags in providing fundamental employee benefits. Looking at a range of benefits from health care to retirement options, companies based in the U.S. rank lower than other comparable developed nations in terms of best benefits. Retirement benefits are another weak spot of the U.S. Older reports indicate that the U.S. comes in 16th place among countries with the best retirement plans. This inequality in U.S. retirement planning extends to racial justice as well. Some 24% of white family households are covered with an employee-sponsored retirement plan, compared to 16% of households of color. Black and Latinx workers also report a lack of retirement savings, with 62% of Black and 69% of Latinx households reporting having no retirement plan. This, as opposed to just 32% of white households. Across the globe, the U.S. also came in 32nd place for highest life expectancy, averaging 78.5. The U.S. is also notoriously stingy with its time paid off, be it for sick leave, parental leave, or general work-life balance. The U.S. shows zero mandated paid holidays, whereas similar countries within the European Union average between 20 to 30 paid holidays for discretionary use. Maternity leave is protected under U.S. labor laws, though, with 12 weeks of unpaid leave being the baseline for companies. Other countries such as Finland, Germany, Japan, and Canada give their employees more time, ranging from 161 weeks down to 52 weeks. The number one place in the U.S. for worker benefits is the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., due to high wage standards and strong worker protections. Also because federal workers tend to be unionized, and because most of the people in D.C., or at least a large fraction of the people in D.C., are federal workers, and thereby, by definition, probably unionized.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, this is all combining with the Republicans' efforts to keep rich people from having to pay taxes.
And non-Republicans from voting.
And non-Republicans from voting. So, you know, it all...
Which, of course, will help keep rich people from paying taxes, because right. Non-Republicans are typically not as rich, and therefore they won't be able to vote.
It's about keeping costs down, even if that cost is, you know, maintaining a decent freedom. Standard of living and freedom.
Keeping costs down, even if the cost is democracy.
Yes. So
we want to keep that. They want to keep that cost down. Okay, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig. There's so much stuff we didn't get to. My co-host, irrepressible co-host, and indispensable editor is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you found it interesting, informative, entertaining, and we'll be back next week and get to stuff that we didn't get to do this week. Everyone take care. Bye-bye.
See you later.
Let's keep on looking for the light. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside.
Magazines, newspapers, cable television, the internet, all sources of news and information, and all cost money. KPFT costs money too, but unlike those other news sources, you get to decide whether you want to help pay for it and how much to contribute. It's unusual in the age of big corporate media to have a quality source of news and information that's paid for voluntarily, but that's one more way KPFT gives you more than you might expect. We can do it thanks to listeners who contribute their voluntary support every year. Please join them. Call 713-526-5738 or go to kpft.org. Again, you can make your gift at kpft.org or call 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. Call now. This is commercial free, listener sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.